Miller House meeting, Thursday afternoon, 3rd of April 1975. If an average intelligent individual man of the world were to listen at one of these meetings, he would quite naturally feel that this is all too idealistic, far removed from the reality of everyday life, with all its problems, its difficulties, its struggles, its failures. That the kind of thing that we consider together here offers no solution to worldly difficulties. Let us very briefly look into the situation. There are three main factors responsible for the state of affairs in the world. One is the cosmos itself, nature, this planet as it is, with its resources, the way it moves, its climate, and so on. Obviously, we can hardly do anything to change the cosmos as such. It is what it is. The second factor is our human institutions and ways of life which have emerged with our cultural development, cultural in both the material and in the psychological and intellectual sense. These institutions are the result of our desires, our needs, and what particular understanding and intelligence we have interacting with the actual circumstance with which we are faced from day to day. And these institutions have grown up through the centuries. We will see that they also are somewhat difficult to change. It is true that in history we do witness when some catastrophe comes about, some violent revolution takes place, we do witness a sudden change. But the suddenness is more apparent than real, because the need for such changes and the desire of men to produce this change, and that desire will also include a vision of a better life, what vision we do have, being what we are, all these forces together ultimately culminate in what is a sudden change in our institutions and so forth. So the change which is brought about that way is not very significant insofar as the real fruition and fulfillment of man himself is concerned. We may notice throughout history, practically without exception, that there comes the time when society, the nation, feels the stress and strain of the new system which has come into being. And there arise people who criticize it and say, well, we really must have a better state of affairs. This simply will not do. And so, what was supposed to usher in a millennium, bringing human happiness, stability, fulfillment, crumbles once again, and some new system comes into being. If human fulfillment in the true sense depended upon changes in systems, then it is an extraordinary thing that in all these thousands of years, man, with all his ingenuity, has been incapable of discovering and establishing a system which would bring about a true human fulfillment. Now we come to the third factor in this situation, and that is man himself. Not man in a general sense as mankind, but as composed of individual human beings. What is the driving force in each individual human being? This is the most important power which brings about our day-to-day situation. What do we desire? What do we strive for? What are our ambitions, our pursuits, our conceptions, our techniques, and so on? And the important point to bear in mind in this connection is that if we look at the world, we will see that all these are related to oneself. Fundamentally, to this egoistic consciousness of self. A consciousness in which I myself stand out very vividly, and the rest of mankind, in fact, all the rest of the world, stands not so vividly and certainly is not of such importance as I myself. Here is the fundamental duality which produces the difficulty, which will produce and continue to produce everlasting conflict. Because as long as in my own mind and consciousness I continue to separate out myself from others, I have firmly established the source, the prolific source of perpetual conflict with my neighbor, with my circumstances, and with the world as such. This is where man fails, and this is where man has to undergo the radical change. A change which means nothing less than the complete transformation of his awareness, the mode of his awareness of existence. His present mode is dualistic, separating self and not self. That has to change into a natural, spontaneous mode of awareness in which the totality functions freely and unrestrictedly through his whole psychophysical being. A psychophysical being which has been purified, perfected, which has been utterly stripped of all the dark things that shut out the light of transcendent reality. This is man's task before him. Now, if this comes about, then all our activities will inevitably change into activities of cooperation with everyone and with every circumstance in an intelligent manner. But do you think that the race of man sees that? Or is prepared to see it? Is the race of man prepared to give up its pleasures, its pursuits, its laziness, its desire to enjoy the dangerous things, the foolish things, the things which are not worthwhile, hoping that he will be able to outwit the consequences of it? There is an excellent reason why it is totally impossible for any man to outwit the consequences of his thought and feeling, his words and his actions. Because all these register in the psyche of man himself. Whatsoever I think and feel, whatsoever I say, whatsoever I do, immediately registers itself in my own mind, my psyche, and in the brain cells and in the very body itself. And these energies immediately start operating, starting with me, myself. That is why in India they are taught, no man can escape his karma, as they called it. It's totally impossible. Not because there is some external judge who wishes to hurt us for doing wrong or to reward us for doing right. But this is the nature of existence. This eternal law is ingrained in all existence. That is why the wise ones taught, the law is above everybody, including eternal God himself. He lives by law, the law inherent in his own being. So now, how was this expressed in very early scriptures? Here is a little passage from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which I have quoted in these two pages. I have only quoted one important sentence. Atma and Brahman, names for realized transcendence, fill the Upanishads. Now the sentence in the Upanishads is this. In the beginning, this was Atma alone in man form, Purusha Vida, as the Sanskrit goes. Looking around, he saw nothing other than Atma. He said first, I am. Thus arose the name I. Now one might naturally think this is an obviously egoistic statement. But the I here is the total I am, the one and only existent reality. Just as in the Old Testament, the Lord God says to Moses, if the Israelites ask you, who has sent you and who are you, then answer, Ehiye, I am, that is, I, Moses, am, Asher, that Ehiye, that I am, the one and only I am, the absolute all. Which means that Moses was in complete attunement with the total reality. The seer, the Holy One, who wrote this in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad was one who had realized this supreme fulfillment. And therefore he wrote, Aham, I am. There is only this one and only I am. It is in that sense that the word is used. And you see that this transcendent sense completely includes every other sense. The limited senses are all integrated into this transcendent sense. And because we climb through these limited senses of the ego feeling, we climb through them stage by stage till we realize the supreme I am. But do remember, when that supreme I am is realized, it is not I, the separately conscious Firoz Mehta, who realizes it. It is the total I am who manifests itself through this finite organism, because it offers no restriction now to the transcendent reality. This is how it happens. No man achieves transcendence. Transcendence cannot be achieved. But transcendence uses the one who has become empty, the zero, the naught, the nothing, uses that one through which to manifest transcendence in human terms and in human form. So, the great teacher in the Upanishad who wrote this, who taught this, said, in the beginning, this was Atma, this total world, in man form. In the beginning, obviously it doesn't refer to time. Because how can you picture time where there is only totality and the transcendent? There is no beginning there. Whenever you come across the phrase in the beginning in the great scriptures of the world, or you come across the word then, atta in Sanskrit, it stands for that state of realized transcendence by the purified Holy One. It stands for this supreme communion, this transcendent realization through that man. He is in that state which is described as in the beginning. Now you'll see the significance of that. I have interpreted it this way. Man, therefore, the perfected man, is transcendence thinking, God thinking, the conceiving by the Holy Ghost, as we call it, in the divine mind itself. So man is transcendence thinking. Now this thinking is obviously not like our thinking. It is not discursive talking, not the making of forms. It is, to use a Christian type of phrase, the Word made flesh, the Word made manifest, the Word symbolizing existence itself. Its heartbeat is love. Its brain is wisdom. Love and wisdom in their transcendent reality. This must be remembered. This man is male, female, the celestial co-equal It is the living image, the fair form of perfect measure of transcendence. I've used phrases which involve Gnosticism, the Hellenistic form of Egyptian wisdom, and various other scriptures. These phrases stand for all that. That man, this transcendent man, is the measure of all creation. If we understand that, if we begin to understand it, we will begin to understand the meaning of, "And God so loved the world that he sent his alone begotten Son." See? Transcendence by self-restriction brings into being an expression of transcendence itself, the Son. It is not the product of desire, of longing. There is no pleasure involved in it. There is no sense of duty or anything else involved in it. It is the absolute creative action of the divine itself. So that man is the measure of all creation. This man, ourselves here and now, who are male and female, separate. That man is male-female simultaneously. It's stated in the first chapter of Genesis 2. And the Elohim made man in their own image. Male-female made he them. Simultaneously male-female. The divine androgyne. This man here, ourselves, the earth child, in his holy state, is the integration of seer and lord and producer and worker. And he can measure all things rightly. In his worldly state, he is in confusion and conflict. And all measures go wrong. All values are false values. In his holy state, your holy state, my holy state, all measure is correct. Why? Because it is not my measure. It is the measure of transcendence itself. In his holy state, in communion, this man, you or I, is identical with that man, the divine creation, the original divine creation. In the silent emptiness of communion, spoken of as in the beginning, the holy ones present the realizing of Atma as being in man form. Because the form that any human being can give as the supreme form must necessarily be restricted to him himself. You and I know ourselves as men and women. It is this which we can visualize in apotheosis. It's an extraordinary thing that the artists of the world have presented their idea of angels and archangels and so forth, who are supposed to be beyond humanity, superhumanity, in human form, but with wings added on. That is about the only difference. And in lovely colors. Isn't it significant? We cannot transcend in our conception the form of man. Now, this is a sort of a cryptic statement in the Upanishad, just as it is in the scriptures of the world, in Genesis, or in the Hellenistic form of Egyptian teaching, the Trismegistic teaching as it is called. You find that the supreme form is man form for man. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the meaning of the word the person. The word person is a sacred word, really. In the Upanishad, it is stated, continuing from that sentence which I read before, that because formerly all this he burned up all evils, therefore he is a person. Now remember that the one who is writing is talking of the state of supreme communion, realized communion. And he calls himself a Purusha, a person, as we say in English. And he explains why he uses the word Purusha for person. Pur is the short form for Purva, meaning formerly, which means in his own lifetime. Formerly, he burned up. And the root, Sanskrit root for burn is ush. He burned up all evil-mindedness. Sarvang, all, papa manam. Manam, mind, papa, sinful. All evil-mindedness. So there you have the supreme key. He who completely burns up all evil-mindedness becomes the true person. Now this true person has nothing to do with what we understand as personality. Personality is a mask. It is an image. Look how all mankind worships the image, the mask, not the true living reality. Personality is the usurper of the person. The person is the divine Lord himself who should reign in his kingdom, which is your own psychophysical being. But instead of this person, the one in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out, instead of him, there is this personality, this almost caricature of the wonderful meaning and significance of man. Remember what I said earlier? Man is transcendence thinking. Thinking meaning creating. Where will you find a man of whom it can be said in this world that here is one who represents transcendence creating? So you see, personality is the usurper of the Lord, like the man who drives away the real king and seizes the throne. He usurps the throne. So this is what we have to grow into. The one in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. Pur Usha. And it is the work which goes on in the lifetime of him who really cares to fulfill the purpose of his existence. Now, the whole of the religious life is directed towards this end. Now, what is the meaning of this burning out? The burning is produced, as we would ordinarily say, by heat. The Sanskrit word is tapas. What is it that gets hotter and hotter inside us? In the psyche, when attentiveness becomes more and more intense, the psyche lights up. It is set alight, set on fire, so to say. And that setting on fire is a fire which destroys nothing whatsoever in our psyche. All that we call evil is not destroyed by this fire. Because what we call evil in our ambivalent state is our psychical energy, our psycho-mental energy expressing itself in the wrong way, in the harmful way. If the psyche were to be burnt up, we would be the losers. We would not be producing destructively. If it were destructively burnt up, there would only be the end of the whole thing. But this fire transforms that energy. It transmutes it. Now, we regard this transformation, we bring the analogy of the gold which is obtained, the pure gold, when all the dross is burnt away. Now the physical analogy is all right up to a point, but only up to a point. In the case of the psyche, the dross as well as the gold is all brought out as pure gold by this fire of the spirit. This tapas, this attentiveness, we talked about attentiveness this morning and living meditatively. This attentiveness is a fire which purifies, which transmutes and releases the energy of the divine itself in you into perfect manifestation. This is the burning up, the tapas, the hotting up. Because tapas has the deeper meaning of attention, of examination. In the modern languages of India, when we say that somebody is examining this, that or the other, or this person or that person, tapas is the word which is used. Now, this burning up then, this fire of the spirit, is called Agni. And Agni is one of the great gods of the Rig Veda. And of course, ordinary scholars, not penetrating into the deep inner meanings, declare that the ancient people whose great religious text was the Rig Veda were a primitive people who worshipped nature gods. Outwardly, it may seem so, but inwardly, this is quite untrue. What are called the nature gods represent the modes in which your own life energy functions. If it functions in this way, the fire of the spirit transforming and purifying you. It was pictured just for convenience and for conveying the inner reality to others as the great god Agni. Similarly, there was the great god Varuna, who was the moral governor of the universe. It doesn't mean that there is some entity, some separate spirit or something which is the moral governor of the universe. It means that within you yourself, as the expression of the virtue of transcendence, is this tremendous moral imperative which knows exactly what is true, what is good and perfect. So the great gods symbolize the transcendent energies as they work in you yourself in different ways. So now, the person means just that, the one in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. And this person, here on earth, is the finite individual expression, therefore. The Holy One is the finite individual expression of that transcendent conception in the divine mind itself, the total reality. This is what we have to grow to. I will give you just one other sentence representing the idea of the Atma. Oh, before that, I think I should just say a word about the famous phrase in the Upanishad, neti, neti, meaning not this, not this, trying to convey the idea, the sense of the Atma, the transcendent reality. The great teacher, Yajnavalkya, says, neti, neti, Atma is not this, not this, not this. And yet, the Upanishads say that Atma is everything. I can give you a very sensible, complete explanation of that, but we must not spend our time on it just at this moment. This statement of Yajnavalkya, that Atma is not this, it is not that. It is unseizable because it cannot be seized. How can you seize? How can the finite catch hold of the infinite? It is indestructible, for it is not destroyed. There is only the process of transformation and change. There is no destruction, no annihilation at all. It is the alone, this is very important, the alone, the associateless, unattached, for it does not attach itself. How can the transcendent attach itself to anything? It is the non-attached but totally permeating everything. There is no need for it to be attached. If it were attached, the transcendent would be bound. Can you imagine God being bound? Quite impossible. Therefore, it does not attach itself. It is unbound. It does not tremble. A most significant phrase. It is not injured. It does not tremble. Why? Because the transcendent reality is that perfect poise of creative action in eternity, which is a pulsation, a vibration. When one is afraid, one trembles with fear, and one can fall down and be defeated. Transcendence cannot fall, transcendence cannot be defeated. It does not tremble. It is utterly devoid of fear. And it's a very interesting thing that this aspect of fear comes in all the great teachings. Not only in the Upanishads, but in all the great religious teachings. The Supreme Reality is totally devoid of fear. What is the ultimate fear? It is the fear of death in the sense of the unknown, which may hold something terrible, something very hurtful for me. That is why one fears death. But when you know death, then there is no fear. But you have to know death. Here whilst alive, in the very real sense, then there is that freedom. I'd like to give a modern form in which one can conceive of Atma . It needs to be considered in deep meditation in the following way. When you yourself, utterly pure, still, silent, free of isolative self-consciousness, are the unresisting, sensitive focus for the free inflow and outflow of transcendence, then that is the meaning of Atma. The meaning of Brahman saying, I am. Not to be thus is the transcendental sorrow, the sorrow which afflicted all those who cared for reality, and which was the great urging power which brought them finally to fulfillment. This is the transcendental sorrow, shoka as it is called. It is the transcendental, far from the infinite suffering. This is the supreme suffering which all the great teachers went through. Every one of them. Zarathustra, Jesus, the Buddha, every one of them goes through this transcendental sorrow, the non-realization of the infinite reality. This is the state of fallen man, Adam in sin. So regard the Atma along those lines, if you wish, in deep meditation, and you will flower out in inward awareness of the reality of Atma without being limited by external concepts and verbal forms. There is something else which I would like to read to you also in this same connection. You all know about yoga. You all know the various aspects of yoga. The purification, which is the indispensable fundamental basis. The discipline of the bodies through the postures and breathing, as it is called, which really means the breathing means not only breathing in and out with the body, but pranayama. Prana is life energy. The full understanding and control of life energy on all planes, including the transcendental plane. This is not written about, not talked about at all. These are all, I haven't come across it anywhere in the written works as such. You see? Then the final stage, which is the entering into the state of communion, the meditation as we call it. and the realizing of the Supreme Communion. Those are the stages of yoga. Now, in the practice of this Kundalini Yoga, the base of the spine is the symbol for earth. The head, the brain, is the symbol for heaven. Isaiah wrote, this is in chapter 66, verse 1, "The heaven is my throne, said the Lord, and the earth is my footstool. Where is the house that ye build unto me? And where is the place of my rest?" And the yogi answers this question of the Lord, "This pure body shall be thy house of life, O Lord. Thy place of rest shall be the center called Anahata, the heart center, which symbolizes the place of union with all mankind. Where else shall the Lord live but there?" Can't live in your elbow or your knee or your little toe or something. In the heart. "Thy place of rest shall be Anahata, whilst the body lives, and in its dying, thou, because thou art the transcendent total reality, shall enter thine own Sabbath." The Sabbath day is called the day of rest, but thine own eternal peace is the meaning of Sabbath, through the portal of Sahasrara, the brain. This is a meditative process. If one has truly realized this in yoga, in the Kundalini yoga particularly, as such, you see, then one knows the answer to these questions. Then too, the fear of death is completely gone. Then too, the clinging to separate personality, the separate I am I, as an identifiable entity through all time and space, all that foolishness disappears. And that is the supreme freedom that the individual man can have. Now all these things can be realized by you, by me. Why do I say this? Consider, who wrote these things? Who taught these things? Did some external god from beyond the skies come down and divulge this in the language which that particular man spoke? Not at all. All this has been the realization for those who cared for transcendence. And because they cared, they went through this process of attentiveness which burnt up, which transmuted all evil inside. And then their awareness, their mode of awareness of existence went through that complete transformation, because of which transcendent reality functioned through them. When they came back from that state of supreme communion, which they are represented by the words "in the beginning" or by the word "then," then once more the mind, in all its analytical processes, brought about the proliferation of this conscious experience of unitary wholeness, and built up all the heavens and hells and angels and archangels and all the rest of it. So you see, this great spiritual world, which we talk of sometimes, is really your own creation. It's not that a spiritual world created you. It's your creation. That is to say, this spiritual world is something which formalizes through man's mind and awareness that which is the formless, the total, the absolute. This has to be carefully borne in mind. So now, if man realizes these things, if there are a sufficient number of people who are like that, then we have a society of holy ones growing up. We use the term holy ones today, but they will be the normal, ordinary humans in the true sense of the word. This is the full meaning of humanity. What sort of life will they live? Will they be driven by desires such as ours? Will they have minds which are confused, which are ambitious, which are cruel, which are inconsiderate, which are thoughtless, and so forth? Which are greedy and possessive, frightened? Oh no, they will be humans. And if you and I, supposing you and I were all like that, and supposing you and I constituted the human race on the globe, do you think there'd be wars? Do you think there'd be all this unpathetic burden of useless sorrow in our lives? Not at all. It's not possible. And it is this kind of society which will naturally produce institutions which are not harmful to anybody. So when the worldling, the man of the world says, oh, you are too idealistic and this and that, and you don't know what you're talking about, you have no touch with reality, one can listen with patience, with deep compassion. And if one has the skill and the circumstance is ripe, one can perhaps say a word or remain silent, which might be even more effective. And just by your very presence, in time, open that man's eyes to a profounder reality. And this alone is something which will produce a world of human living where the prison state of the world will be a long forgotten ugly dream of the past. And man will live as man. The secular life and religious living will be an identity then. And that is perhaps one way of understanding the reality of religious living.